Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. We're going to be covering the last of the original trilogy films, Return of the Jedi, this week, made in 1983. First, I'd like to do a little feedback. This is feedback mostly from my post of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. And I want to thank Jeremy Nessie, Seth Heasley, and Aaron Backer for replying to, we had a little fun on my Facebook page doing lines from Star Trek IV. There's some Twitter activity. I want to thank Matt Hurt for favoriting my Star Trek IV tweet. I want to thanks to Joseph Dickerson, who added me to a list of people who post about Trek. That is definitely me. On Reddit, I want to thank the user Sweet Bear Cub, clued me into this little bit of a little more trivia about Star Trek IV. Quote, a further bit regarding the extra that talks to Chekhov and Uhura. Not only did she pop out a cool line that they kept in the movie and inducted her into SAG, but she was only on the set because she found out that her car had been towed for filming and she needed the cash to get her car out of hock. Then it says she's currently a radio host and fashion designer. So funny little bit of trivia. Thank you again for everyone who tweets, who likes, who retweets, who writes things to me. Appreciate all the feedback. I really like engaging online. And I know people are out there listening, so it's great. Let's move into a little background info on Jedi. As with Empire, Lucas personally financed Return of the Jedi himself. Star Wars was the last film, I think, that he ever needed a studio to produce. Distribute, I guess, is something else. There are persistent rumors that he wanted Spielberg to direct Jedi. Early research, because of the credit sequences in his movies, that the Directors Guild said you can't have no credits before a movie starts. And Lucas's, you know, Star Wars famous openings, right? It's always 20th Century Fox intro, and then you have the crawl, and then you're in the movie. There are absolutely no credits in front of any of the six Star Wars films. And I think that got Lucas, maybe other things, but got him kicked out of the Directors Guild. So the guild wouldn't let, I think, wouldn't let Spielberg do Jedi because he was a Directors Guild member. And, you know, it was going to be kind of a non-union gig and he was verboten. All rumor. I don't know if any of that is true, but I've heard it enough year over year that I thought I would just put it in the podcast. So this is kind of interesting. Lucas approached David Lynch first, I guess, when he couldn't get Spielberg, who had just been nominated for Best Director for Elephant Man in 80 for Jedi. Lynch declined. Then he asked Cronenberg to direct. He declined. It's like two directors who are about as far from Lucas's vision as you could possibly imagine. These unique, you know, singular voices. It's amazing. And no surprise that neither one of them would touch someone else's, you know, toy collection with a 10-foot pole. So I just thought it was strange, Lucas. Either he just didn't know anything about the films these men made, or I don't know. He did, and there were reasons for him thinking about them as directors. I don't know. It blows me away when I think about it. Like, what would David Cronenberg's Return of the Jedi look like? You know, maybe it would be great. Maybe the Ewoks would have all been really creepy and disgusting. And anyway, so he eventually chose this guy Richard Marquand. Now Marquand had done one really cool film, which was The Eye of the Needle. In 1981, which is the Donald Sutherland World War II spy thriller. I think the only thing that he's really known for. After Jedi, he made a film called Jagged Edge and then Nowhere to Run. I believe he's the writer on. So kind of a nowhere person. He's out of nowhere. I mean, at least Kirshner was known as a player and he was, you know, was Lucas's professor at USC. But Marquand was just a strange, you know, guy with a camera, basically. Supposedly, Lucas directed a lot of the second unit work as well as the shootings threatened to go over schedule at some point. And it's a function that Lucas had performed on previous occasions when he'd only officially been producing a film, such as More American Graffiti and Raiders. Like he got behind a camera, helped out, and did some stuff. So Lucas himself admits that he was on the Jedi sets frequently due to Mark Han's relative inexperience with special effects. He praised Mark Han as a very nice guy, worked well with actors. Mark Han did note that Lucas kept a conspicuous presence on set. And he says, quote, "It is rather like trying to direct King Lear with Shakespeare in the next room." So I'm sure it was not an easy gig for him. The script was written by Lawrence Kasdan and Lucas, which was similar to Empire. There were contributions uncredited by David Webb Peebles, Mark Han as well. Kasdan claims he told Lucas that Jedi was a weak title. Lucas later decided to name the film Revenge of the Jedi, then flipped back, obviously. The screenplay wasn't finished until very late in production. And most of the production team relied on Lucas's story, the rough story, and the draft to start work in the art department and getting all the, the creatures made and so on and so forth. So when it came time to formally write a shooting script, Lucas, Kasdan, Mark Han, and this guy Kazanchian spent 2 weeks in conference discussing ideas, and then Kasdan used taped transcripts of these meetings to then write. So there was this issue of whether or not Harrison Ford was going to return because he did not contract to do two sequels, and Raiders had made him an even bigger star than normal. So Ford earlier had suggested that Han be killed through self-sacrifice, at the end of Empire. He kind of said, Lucas, why don't you kill Han off at the end of Empire? Lucas, knowing a little better about what this franchise was going to mean, said, you're crazy. Lawrence Kasdan, the writer, actually concurred, saying that, for Jedi, maybe it should happen at the beginning of the film to instill doubt as to whether the others would survive. But Lucas was like, said, you're crazy. Gary Kurtz, who produced Star Wars and Empire, claimed in 2010 that the ongoing success with Star Wars merchandise and toys led Lucas to reject killing off Han. Oh, duh, A couple of things. Luke was originally meant to walk off alone and exhausted like the hero in a spaghetti western. But Lucas opted for a happier ending to encourage higher merchandise sales. It's kind of specious. I don't know about that, right? Yoda was originally not meant to appear in the film, but Mark Han strongly felt that returning to Dagobah was essential to resolve the dilemma raised by the previous film, which is kind of true. The inclusion led Lucas to insert a scene in which Yoda confirms that Vader is Luke's father because he had a discussion with a child psychologist because he didn't want younger moviegoers to dismiss Vader's claim as a lie because no one's corroborating it, right? So when you're in Jedi, you still like, is it true? Is it not true? One little thing, the Ewoks were supposed to be Wookiees, but that was changed. Let's get to the film. Very similar, Star Wars, always the openings, the crawl, and then you're in space, and then we have a little camera shift. This time it's a very similar opening to episode 4. You have another Star Destroyer coming overhead, which to my mind heralds how samey this film will kind of be. Like, in a way, it's weird. To me, Jedi is kind of like the beginning, it's kind of the exhaustion of Lucas's ideas that he ran through the first two films, and he was kind of running out of ideas here, which is hard to believe, thinking, the universe that he was in. But this time, you get the without the intense rumble, you have the sound design of the original Star Wars. You had this intense sound with the Star Destroyer, which made it such an incredible experience. This time, no sound at all, and you follow an Imperial shuttle that detaches. We see a brand new unfinished Death Star. So again, another Death Star, very similar to the first film. We are setting up what's going to come later in terms of the strike mission needing a security code to drop the defense screen. So, we hear that going back and forth between the shuttle pilot and the Death Star personnel that they need the security code to clear. And then we're in a hangar bay. It's a great Vader entrance. We see, I think it's Jar Jarrod is the Imperial commander. He gulps and we see his Adam's apple bob because he's, scared shitless. The camera's very low. We just see the ramp lower and then we see black boots and a cape and then it pans up and it's a great, great intro for Vader. And there's that brief discussion. He's there to put them back on schedule and kind of a quasi-comedic line, I always think, where at the end he tells, the Emperor is not as forgiving as I am. Which is like, setting up the Emperor, first of all, as the new, supreme baddie in this film. And, Vader, in a sense, is the number two man here. So then we've got the Tatooine sequence. One of the first shots is R2 and 3PO walking down a long road, and it's very similar to the first film. Again, I'm getting echoes of A New Hope. There's this really cool castle. It's Jabba's basically, his castle. And there's this weird-looking ball that comes out of one of the openings in the door. And 3PO gets to speak that language. There's a lot of, 3PO being the translator. is a big deal in this film. It's kind of cool. He's kind of more important than R2. I think R2 is kind of the key to Empire in some ways, and 3PO is kind of gets his due. So then we come across our first new Star Wars creature, the Gamorrean Guard, which is these kind of squat-looking, it's like a walking wild boar, these tusks. Very cool-looking, you know, I don't mind them. They have this great deep guttural growl. I think they did a great job with them. And then we meet a creature called the Twi'lek, and the character's name is Bib Fortuna, and it's this... these characters that have these two massive sort of tentacles coming out of the bottom of their back skull. We're going to see one or two more in a bit more, but Bib is sort of like Jabba's sort of main counselor. He's got these red eyes, really cool looking again, really well done, very realistic in the scene, you know, makeup and special props and stuff. So then we were introduced to Jabba's palace. It's our first look, I believe, at Jabba the Hutt. If you don't talk about the special edition crap that Lucas put in A New Hope where he sees him. It's the first time we're seeing Jabba. And he's basically a big slug, which is just amazing. And he's got they do the eyes really well, you know. The eyes are very clear and they're very, like, however they constructed them, these glass oblong balls, they look great. And they make you kind of forget how quasi not so real the rest of it looks. But, you know, the eyes are really great. So then we get the story point of, you know, Luke, R2 plays the hologram of Luke, and we see Luke is kind of a little bit older. He looks a little more, you know, a little more settled, a little more gravitas to him. And there's the gift of the droids, right, that they're going to now work for Jabba. Another creature we meet is Salacious Crumb, which is the little creature that sits at Jabba's, right, at the foot of Jabba and just has these crazy laughs. And then we see the first shot of Solo in carbonite since Bespin. So we see that Solo is there adorning one of the walls of Jabba's main area there. And then they bring the droids in to, like, the back rooms of sort of Jabba's, you know, castle. It's just an odd scene where they're torturing a droid. Like, there's this droid we've seen before in the Death Star where they're, like, walking sort of luggage boxes, right? And they have these feet. And they turn one upside down and they're, you know, they're pulling down these hot pokers and torturing it. And it's just like... I don't know. It was the first weirdness of, and it gets worse in my mind here. But I was just like, torturing a droid? It doesn't make any sense, you know? Like, I don't understand what the purpose of it was. Like, you know, Jabba's evil, but why would you torture a droid? They don't feel anything. And you hear this little voice screaming as the feet get burned. I don't know. It was just very weird. So, you know, their respective jobs is 3PO becomes Jabba's interpreter, which is cool. And R2 basically becomes this, he's basically a server on the sail barge, which we'll get to very shortly. And then we're full on into Jabba's sort of, he's having a celebration. And, you know, this is meant to be another throwback to the cantina scene in Star Wars. I mean, we're on Tatooine. This movie has been almost like so many mirror images from the first film. Which, to my mind, makes it less interesting because, you know, it's not Hoth. Hoth was brand new. Snowspeeders were new. AT-AT walkers were new. The probe droid was new. Tauntauns were new. Like, you got all this new stuff that was really cool. And now all we get really is just weird aliens. But the music's even worse. It's like funk music. Whereas in Mos Eisley, the band was great, man. This cool jazz band, and they were very cool. The music was good. It's just not as interesting as the Mos Eisley cantina scene. Even the aliens, like, the aliens aren't as cool. You know, there's this character, Max Rebo, who's the blue sort of elephant alien playing the keyboard. Like, it's just, it's weird. And then the main singer, which is this really weird alien. So her name is Cy Snoodles. She is a Palawick singer. You know, this singing this stuff, but she's dressed really weird. Like, it's just, all of it is just very odd. And it's not, I don't know, it's not fun and cool. I think an alien should be. And the song's not very interesting. And, you know, already we're opening Star Wars and Empire relatively adult. And to me, to my mind, what's happening here is we're in Toyland already. It's very goofy. The aliens are kind of goofy. Everything is sort of like very PG-13, extremely PG-13, you know, already. And then, you know, we do get some harsh, the female Twi'lek is dancing in front of Jabba. You know, they dump her into the pit. Of course, we don't see the Rancor yet. We just hear it. And then there's this other kind of gross thing of Jabba eating this live food that's swimming around in this little bowl next to him, which is really kind of, it's a good detail. It's kind of gross, but I think it's good. I don't know. Already, there's just fun fakeness to things that I don't know. It's just it strikes me as very weird. I never really liked it. So now we get Chewie brought in by a bounty hunter named Boosh. Lucas with his crazy names. Boosh is an actual bounty hunter. It was an actual bounty hunter for real and in the expanded universe. And there's some backstory about Boosh and when Boosh was killed, you know, that his armor was given to the Republic, you know, and so on and so forth. So we see Boba Fett also at this point, and Jabba looks really great, as I said before. And so, you know, the gambit here is that this bounty hunter is bringing Chewie in for a reward and they haggle over the price. And this bounty hunter was famous for, you know, this carrying thermal detonators around. So, you know, obviously Leia, keeping to her costume, does that. And we also see Lando in a corner disguised as one of the guards. So everyone's there. So they haggle, you know, they agree on a price, and Jabba really likes Boosh. You're my kind of scum, right? And then we cut quickly to late night. Everyone's supposedly asleep. Boosh goes and frees Han, pushes the sort of freeing sequence on the carbonite, and, you know, Han sort of brought out of it. It's not a great scene. He kind of glows red for a while and then he falls out. I don't know. It doesn't look that great. But of course, it's Leia in disguise of Boosh. So, and Han is blinded at this point. And then, of course, the screen reveals behind them and Jabba's been waiting for them, somehow knowing that this was all BS. But there's this nice scene of Han and Chewie when they're reunited in a cell. You know, Chewie grabs them and, you know, they're back together again. It's just sweet. So then Luke arrives. And he chokes two of the Gamorrean guards who try to stop him. And he's cloaked. You know, he's in kind of Jedi. He's in full Jedi regalia now. But he's all in black. He looks great. He manipulates Bib Fortuna with the same kind of trick that Kenobi used on the stormtroopers back in Mos Eisley years ago. So again, another echo of Star Wars. You know, when he's bargaining for the life of, you know, Chewbacca, Han, and Leia, it doesn't work on Jabba. You know, his mind tricks don't work on you know, a creature of his kind. But Hamill looks great. He looks very weathered, looks serious, you know, definitely not the cocky young boy in 1977. He definitely looks aged for sure. We have Leia in the metal bikini. And I have to say, you know, I am a feminist man. I believe in the equality of the sexes in most things, but she looks really, really good in this thing. She's so hot in this bikini. It's really ridiculous. Really, 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 really hot. And supposedly what they did was they fitted her with the costume at the beginning of production, and then she went off to film some other things, some other parts of the film first, and when she got back and was ready to do the Jabba scenes, she had lost a bunch of weight, so the costume was a little loose on her, which I cannot tell at all, but she just looks insanely hot. So then we have the Luke versus the Rancor scene, which is okay. You know, the Rancor is pretty cool. They did this cool thing where it was an animatronic puppet, and they filmed it at an extremely high frame rate so that they had to actually, the guy doing the puppetry had to move the thing around really quickly. And I guess when they slowed it down, it had that look as it looks now. So they did a pretty good job with the Rancor. Like, it's a disgusting, creepy looking thing. And there's some nice moments in the fight where Luke puts the bone in its mouth, but it crushes it. Reminded me of a similar scene in Attack of the Clones when one of those monsters snaps the lance that's stuck in its mouth, you know, kills it by the metal door coming down, which is pretty clever. But then it's marred by this goofy moment where the Rancor, I guess, has a master, like it's the Rancor keeper, and he comes on screen and he just starts crying because his pet is dead. And I was just like, what are you doing, George? You know, like, it's just, I don't know. It was, again, it was, you know, you had a pretty intense scene and a pretty creepy monster, which was great. And then there's this goofy crying scene of this bad actor and bad, like, caveman get up. So, again, just another weird part of this movie that already it's the least of the three. You know, we're not even through the first act yet. So, and then there's a sail barge scene, which is pretty cool looking shit. R2 as a waiter is pretty funny. You know, Max Rebo is on board, so you see the blue elephant again. It's kind of goofy still. You know, the effects now, George did a lot of CGI stuff. There were a lot of, you know, real built stuff, but not all of it. So, like, they would only build part of something, and then they would finish with CGI. You can tell it's dated. I mean, that's not a criticism, because at the time it was cutting edge. But at this point, you know, what always feels true to me is that the effects in Empire and Jedi feel more dated than the effects in The New Hope. The New Hope effects, because they were so realistic and all done with models and real things, they don't date, you know? They just don't date. They look as good as they ever have. And Empire and Jedi, when George was getting fancy, you know, pushing things forward, obviously, you know, pushing things forward in the business, by creating all the stuff, which then opened up, you know, the floodgates to do all these kind of movies. But still, it's dated. So then there's the scene where Leia strangles Jabba, which is a great scene, you know, like, because it's really there, you know, the Jabba is an animatronic thing really there, and the tongue's lolling out. But it's good because Leia's very intense. And in, you know, most of this film to come, the actors are basically dancing around. No one looks like they're straining themselves at all in anything that they're doing. It all looks like they're just kind of walking through the movie. But this is one moment where Leia, Carrie Fisher, really shines, and she's great. As she strangles Jabba and his, you know, his tongue lolls out at the end is awesome. So then, you know, we get this wonderful thing of R2 launches Luke's saber. He is on his little platform about to be thrown into the Sarlacc, right? Which is that that creature with the, you know, all the teeth that you supposedly digested for 1,000 years. It's fun. He flips up from the plank, grabs his saber. It's green, which is the first time we're seeing a new color saber. All we've seen is blue and red so far. So that's kind of cool. And he makes mincemeat out of the barge crew that was there. It's kind of cool. And then Lando ends up at the end of a rope sort of dangling over the Sarlacc as the barge kind of, some of the repulsor lifts on the barge were damaged. So it kind of, it cants sort of to the right a little bit. And, you know, we have our tension. And we finally get to see Boba Fett's rocket pack in action, right? Because he's carrying the thing around. He's got this thing on his back. Who the hell knows what it's for? But he, you know, rockets into action. Then he goes at Luke, ties him up with that rope, which is kind of goofy. But Luke gets out of it. And actually, Han's the one who takes Boba Fett out. Blind, he kind of hits him with one of these, you know, Gather sticks that he has. You know, something goes wrong with his rocket, and into the Sarlacc he goes. There's been all kinds of speculation that he doesn't die. He's wearing some kind of special armor called the Mandalorian armor, which perhaps has special properties. I think the Mandalorians were a famous military group. So it's possible that, I don't know if in the extended universe if he turns up or not, but, you know, be curious to see in the sequel films that are coming out very soon, if Boba makes an appearance. It all ends up, there's a funny scene with Lando, actually, when Han has got a blaster out and he's trying to shoot one of the tentacles. And Lando's like, I thought you were blind, telling him a little higher with the weapon. And, you know, he shoots the tentacle and everyone is saved. They blow off the sail barge, you know, all is well. And we're done with Tatooine. So just to summarize the opening sequence, I mean, you know, plot-wise, it is what it is, right? They go rescue Han. But I'm not getting a real sense of my characters here. Like, there's so much goofy stuff thrown in. The goofy Rancor Minder, Salacious Crumb, the singer. There's just a cheap kind of veneer to things here that just, I don't know, it never comes across as with the realness of the first two films where, you know, obviously everything's fake and made up. But there's something to things here already where there's like a sheen of fakeness to things that I don't know. It makes it, to me, just the lightest of the three films. The dialogue between the heroes is okay, but it's not nearly as zippy as the first two films. Like, it's already kind of slack in weird ways that I can't really put my finger on, frankly. And definitely, you know, the level of the film is, even though there's monsters and stuff going on, like, I feel like I'm in a kid's movie, big time. And, you know, that will only get worse as we get to Endor. Luke goes back to Dagobah. You know, Han and Leia and Chewie and the droids head back to the Alliance rendezvous. And then we get to the Emperor's entrance of the Death Star. The wonderful entrance of Ian McDiarmid, who's just amazing. He's the best thing in the prequels, I think, and one of the best things in Jedi. He's just, you know, when a real actor steps into a movie like this, you're just like, oh, that's what acting is, right, okay. And he's got this great red guard around him, you know, that have the helmets, I think, were designed on like medieval knight helmets, but they're really cool looking. You know, they got these staffs. You never really see them in action, but they're just new, you know, and they look great. He's got this great vocal delivery as the Emperor, and he's hooded. Like, he's really like this, you know, anti-Yoda, just this creepy little gnome of a guy. It's a good scene between him and Vader. It really sets up that, you know, he's pulling strings on all this stuff, much, you know, unknown to our heroes, that he's really kind of machinating things, so. So then we're back on Dagobah, and this is a great sequence. Yoda has definitely aged since Luke has left. Oz made the voice a little bit older as well, which is kind of cool. There's a funny line when 900, because Luke notices that he's a little older and he can't hide it. And Yoda says, when 900 years old you reach, look as good, you will not, which is good. So he's told by Yoda that he is not a Jedi yet, that he will only be one until he faces Vader. And we clear up a bunch of plot stuff that was dumped on us in the last film. He confirms that Vader is Luke's father. He tells Luke not to underestimate the power of the Emperor. And then he dies with this, like, very dramatic, there is another Skywalker, without telling Luke who the other Skywalker is. So a little over the top. But then, as he's about to leave, Ben's Force Ghost comes, and we have this which I call bullshit on every time, this awkward explanation about Luke's like, why didn't you tell me he was my father? And Vader's like, well, you know, technically he's your father, but really, you know, your father died the minute Vader was born and from a certain point of view. And I was sort of like, bullshit, you know, but it is what it is. I mean, it works ultimately. It's just, it is a bit of a left turn. And then we get the another Skywalker, and it's Leia as the sister, which makes some of the, you know, scenes in the first movie kind of awkward. But it is what it is. So, you know, we lay out all the family lines now in this universe are all pretty much set in stone. Everybody knows what's up. From the goofy Jabba's palace stuff, like, this is really, to me, the core of Jedi, which makes it at least, you know, not completely, you know, irredeemable, because I don't like it very much as a film. But the stuff between Luke and Yoda and Vader and the Emperor is great. And I'll get to the end. I think the ending is such a genius move on Lucas's part in such a wonderful way that almost pulls this film back. But it's great. And Luke is very serious. And Hamill's great, man. He's so different than he used to be. He's really dialed it down a little bit. And it's just really solid stuff, you know. And we see the death of Yoda, which is kind of sad. You know, he just vanishes. And it's definitely a weird shift after the first part of the movie. But, you know, it brings you back to Earth. You're like, oh, yeah. Yeah, Empire was great. That's right. I forgot, you know. Then we cut to the whole Rebel Alliance rendezvous, which is great. All these different crazy ships, Mon Calamari cruisers, and, you know, we see lots of transports from Empire. Like, there's all kinds of crazy ships. It's like a ragtag fleet. It's great. And we see Admiral Akbar, who I think totally works as the calamari, as it were. Lucas named him when he was at an Italian restaurant one day. But he's great. He has, again, you know, the eyes. They do the eyes really well. Like Jabba's eyes. They must have had these wonderful glass balls, you know, and they just, it pops the character out. And he looks really cool. And there's a little speech by this woman named Mon Mothma, who I guess is the head of the Alliance at the moment. They find out that the Emperor is going to be on the Death Star. And there's this whole classic Lucas, right? There's multiple things that have to go on, you know. So one group will deactivate the shield on the planet. Another group will attack the Death Star. But again, I think to myself, that's just another Death Star mission. I mean, we've seen this before, you know? Some of the extra stuff you get with the Blu-ray set, you even hear the guy saying, well, you know, the first Death Star scene, you know, it was, we had the trench, so this time we had to up the stakes. So instead of going down a trench, you know, they go into an enclosed space. I was like, really, guys? You're upping the ante. I don't know. It's kind of a letdown to me. Like, oh, it's just going to be another Death Star assault. And we've seen it all before, you know? So to me, it's kind of boring. It doesn't keep me, I'm not so much invested. The mission's kind of laid out. Whatever strange directions things go in, it's not going to veer too far off from what they're set out to do. So I don't know. There's just something about it that's, I was just like, oh, okay, another Death Star mission. There's a warm scene here when Leia's sitting next to Han, and they say, they're talking about the strike mission. She's like, I wonder who they found to pull that off, you know? So some good lines are still here. Once Han admits that it's him, the everyone volunteers, Leia and Chewie, and then Luke pops him out of nowhere and says, I'm in, you know? And it's a nice subtle touch here when Luke arrives and they sort of come together. Like, Han is addressing him as Luke, not kid anymore, which I think is right, because Luke's not a kid anymore. You know, it is to you owe me, Junior, right? He actually thanked him earlier for coming to rescue him. So, like, Luke has kind of earned his manhood. Han kind of, you know, subtly reflects that. I think it was a really smart little choice in the script, you know. Then there's a weird dialogue between Lando and Han, which I thought could be so much funnier, but it was just not. Lando's going to take the Falcon on the assault because, you know, Han's going in the Imperial shuttle. You know, there's like not a scratch, but it's just, all right, already, all right. You know, it's a dead scene. It's just dead. I don't know if it's edited that way, but it's so flat and badly acted and, I don't know, edited. Just a good chunk of this movie, the stuff between the characters is just flat and dead. It could be that just Marquand can't do comedy. You know, Marquand sucks at comedy, where Kirsch could do dramatic and comedy. Lucas could do dramatic and comedy as well, but Marquand, when it comes to the funny stuff, and maybe because he was pretty much a dramatic director, they didn't know how to edit or do comedy, and Lucas didn't help him out. So anyway, and there's one funny moment, not funny moment, but there's a moment for me, as I've said in previous podcasts, I'm a big Admiral Piett fan. When they show up in the shuttle at the Endor Moon, you know, the Star Destroyer that's clearing them for landing, there's Admiral Piet's there because it's Vader's flagship, right? That massive super Star Destroyer. And I gave out a little cheer. I'm like, hey, he's still alive, you know? He actually survives. There's a funny line about fly casual. There's some nice banter here in the shuttle. And there's a great scene when the shuttle flies by the bridge of the super Star Destroyer. You really get a sense of the scale of how big the bloody thing is because it's very close, and the shuttle is a decent-sized shuttle, and just the bridge itself is like this looming huge wall. It's really cool, really cool. But we're getting the story information that Vader knows Luke's on the shuttle, but he lets it land anyway. They get by, and, you know, whatever. I wanted to mention, too, like the dialogue, and I talked about it a little bit between Han and the dialogue is very stilted between everybody for the most part, you know, and it wasn't the greatest in the Tatooine stuff, but since the Rebel briefing, it's just weird. Like, there are weird beats and pauses between things. I've never figured out whether it was just the looping director was bad. Everything feels very disjointed when characters talk to each other, somehow, like, almost out of sync in a weird way. And it makes it hard. To me, dialogue, other than, you know, the Emperor, Luke, and Vader on the Death Star, I never feel like I'm in the grip of a really good scene. I never feel like the dialogue is really flowing back and forth between the principals. I always feel like characters show up, you know, mouth a few lines and go on. And I don't remember that in the first two movies. You know, the first two movies had scenes. They were funny. They were real scenes. And it made the movie feel real where, I don't know, here, it just, very rarely is there a full scene. And when there is, it's, the dialogue is just, I don't know whether it's editing, but I never really liked it. So, and I've noticed it from the very first time I saw it, that there was something odd about this film. Anyway, so we start off now on Endor, and the setting is great. I mean, you know, it is what it is, right? But it looks real. They're in a jungle. Like, it looks good. Han has a funny line where he's got to take out the speeder bikers. So he's like, we got to do this quiet. And he's like, hey, it's me, remember? Pretty solid. And then we get the speeder bike chase, which is pretty great. And I think back to 1983, what a thrilling sequence it was cinematically. You know, who had ever seen anything like that before? Reminded me of the car chase scene in French Connection when the camera's in front, you know? So it was done, this guy Garrett Brown, who was sort of the pioneer of the Steadicam, they got him in and they marked out some paths in the jungle. So he walked the paths. I think he walked them at a pace that was like one frame per, you know, they slowed the film down and had him walk as well. So then when they just simply played the film at a normal pace, it looked like that you were flipping through it. Like, they gauged it where it was like the equivalent to 100 miles an hour. So however fast he was walking, they slowed the film down, you know, initially when it was being exposed. But it's really cool. It really, really looks great. The bikes look really good close up, you know, very beat up as they would be on a jungle moon, you know, filled with moisture, and they look cool. You know, when we get the green screen shots of the actors riding the bikes, there's not enough wind in their faces, really. It really looks fake, and it's definitely dated, and it's just not as visceral, you know? And that's part of, you know, movies have changed a lot since then, too. I mean, things have gotten very visceral now. Like, the believability factor in most sequences is incredible, you know, what they're doing. And this is still, you know, go up on the green screen, film a few shots, we'll stick it in the main action. And it's kind of, that's what it is. But at the same time, they're not being directed intensely either. So, you know, they're on these 100-mile-an-hour speeder bikes, and it looks like they're, you know, sitting on a porch sipping tea. You know, there's not enough intensity in their faces. And I blame Marquand on that. I mean, that's something that as a director, you need. You know, you need them to be like, look, you know, you're in a jungle. Trees are coming at you 100 miles an hour. You'd look like nearly terrified, like you were going to die because these things are going so fast. And it's just not, you know, to me. And so as part of what I was saying earlier, there's a lot of sequences in this film where the actors are just kind of walking through it. And this is one of them. It's a cool sequence and the bikes are great. And there's this kind of cool moment where Luke is saber versus a speeder bike, and Luke shears off this what they call the steering vane, which is at the very tip, and the bike spins around, smashes against a tree. So Luke gets a little saber workout here, which is kind of cool. So now we come to the very divisive part of this movie. We are introduced to the Ewoks. And I have to say, the very first introduction to them is actually pretty cool. This one Ewok, I think because of the wide eyes of the face and the facial prosthetic, it actually looks really cool. It doesn't look cute, right? It's got these cool braids in its fur, and it's wearing kind of a cool outfit, and it's wearing a spear, and yeah, it's a teddy bear. We all know it, right? But I don't know. The first look is actually pretty cool. the Ewok that wakes Leia up. I don't mind it at this very moment, right? But, you know, it's not taking Leia as a friendly until she kills two speeder pilots, and then all of a sudden, like, they're buddies because she, you know, they're the enemy of the Ewoks as well. So then there's this, you know, now we're really heading into goofy land. Han and the droids and Luke are netted by the Ewoks. They come across this big piece of raw meat, and no one are really smart. You know, Alliance fighters have no idea what it is until the net closes on them. R2 cuts them out with one of his cutting tools, which I think is kind of cool. And then the Ewoks sort of descend in mass. And there's like a medicine man Ewok, who's probably the leader. Really cool looking. Looks a little different. I think his fur is a little gray. He's got, you know, this cool garb. Just definitely cool looking. You know, I got to give costume and design its due where it is, you know, and it looks really kind of cool. But at this point now, it's an attack of the cute, really. You know, 3PO becomes the god. How funny. You know, there's obviously there's an Ewok language, which was probably derived. I didn't even bother looking up because, frankly, I don't care. There's a funny line of Han's, why don't you use your divine influence and get it out of this, which I like. There's the Ewok village in the trees, which is kind of cool. You know, it's like very similar to Lothlorien in Tolkien's books, where you have these wraparound staircases and they get to, you know, one or another trees by, you know, by vines, which is kind of cool. So the design is really neat. Our heroes now are kind of ready to be spit roasted. And there's a funny line by 3PO, you're about to be the main course at a banquet in my honor. Leia comes out in native garb, but she looks hot again. Her hair's down. I think it must have been a weave, but it's really long hair she's got. But she looks really terrific, not in a uniform. You know, she tries to get 3PO to free them. And there's this moment where Luke has to use the Force to levitate 3PO, which is okay. You know, it's kind of cool. It's a clever idea. R2 shocks the Ewoks, which I was like, yes, R2, I love you. He had me at the first shock. Okay, so haha. So they're all friends now, and now we see the Ewoks kind of gathering around that night. 3PO is taking center stage, and he's telling the story so far. And we hear those, you know, little sound effects that he's generating from inside, and it's kind of cool. But who cares? You know, like, it's all just so uninteresting and childlike. This is all for the kids. You know, there's no drama. There's no real danger here. It's all goofy and fun and okay, you know, haha, we're going to sell 8 zillion Ewok toys. Good for George, right? But there's one good scene in all of this when Luke takes Leia outside and explains to her that they're brother and sister, which is a nice scene. It still has timing problems, but it's a pretty good, you know, it's like the first real scene in the movie that's about something besides the Dagobah scenes. So it's pretty cool. And then, you know, Luke leaves and Han witnesses, I think he saw the kiss. And so Leia pushes him away and, you know, more for story dramatics than for anything else because she's kind of shocked by the revelation. But I don't know. It's just a weird scene. But Han comes first. He's pissed off at her, and then he comes back and he apologizes, and she's like, "Hold me." And it's kind of sweet, you know. Han and Leia are very sweet together. And then we have a great scene. You know, the beginnings of the menace you're finally getting to feel in this film, where Luke surrenders to Vader. You know, he has this moment where he's like, "That's why you won't turn me over to your Emperor now." And he thinks that he's gonna pull at whatever good strings are in Vader's chest, so like Vader and Luke will go away together somewhere and just bail. Vader in kind light ignites Luke's saber right behind him, and he's like, "You've constructed a new lightsaber. The Emperor will show you the true nature of the Force." But then it ends with, "It's too late for me, son." Right? But it's very clever and subtle writing, right? Why would he even acknowledge? Obviously, he wants to acknowledge their kinship, but I don't know. There's something about that where, you know, Vader's turn doesn't seem too outlandish. Because of this scene, I think, "It's too late for me, son." Like, that line gives you what you need when later Vader dumps the Emperor over the side. That, I don't know, they set it up in some way. I don't know how it worked, but it seems to me it works. So, all right, so now we get our endgame, and Lucas, as usual, does the three-prong attack. I'll talk about Endor first. Using the indigenous population, right, the rebels are alerted to the back door to the shield generator base. The goofy young Ewok draws off a bunch of the troopers by taking one of their speeder bikes, which is, okay, whatever. They gain entrance, but it's all a trap. That's the great line when the Imperial commander comes in, "You rebel scum," and they're captured, right? Because we're cutting back and forth to getting the Emperor's, you know, point of view on things. It's a full legion of troops, and we get the new walkers. Finally, something fucking new, you know, that's cool. The what they call the AT-STs, which are like the scout walkers. They only have on two legs, but they look great. Really cool looking things. And first, you know, it was the first time I was like, you know, the Death Star we've seen Imperial shuttles. You know, there were some new ships in the Alliance fleet, but it's like, you know, the AT-AT scout. It's great. Looks really cool. But then it's basically the teddy bear attack. This whole battle here, you know, to my mind, I can never get past the fact that, you know, these are stormtroopers who wear armor that's battle hardened against lasers, right? Their armor deflects blaster bolts, and somehow they're losing to, you know, the teddy bear army of bows and arrows and rocks. It's stupid. This is the place where, if you're like me, most Star Wars fans, like, you know, we've swallowed the Jabba Palace crap, but this is way too far. He's gone too far this time, if I may use one of his quotes. You know, it's teddy bears versus the Imperials, and it's terrible. The only time it gets even remotely interesting is when they have these tactics against the walkers. One of the tactics is to release, you know, a whole bunch of logs, and it actually, the one walker can't walk on the log, so it collapses. And then there's really one cool scene where they cut these cables holding these two massive logs that, when they come together, they just pulp Walker right between them, which is really cool. You think these little guys, you know, they came up with some really cool shit. And there's one moment, I can only imagine that this must have been an insert when they were watching the first dailies or the first cut of the film. Someone must have piped up and said, George, you got to show some Ewoks getting killed or no one's going to give a shit or believe any of this. It's too stupid. So we have two Ewoks. One of them gets shot, and we realize quickly that it's the child has lived, but the mother is dead. But it's like, to me, it's way too little, too late. And then, kind of cool, you get Chewie's assault, right? Chewie swings on a vine to the top of one of the walkers, and if you're listening closely, there's a Tarzan yell here, which, again, adds to the absurdity of the whole thing, that this is just one big comedy now. So he does his Tarzan yell, he gets into an AT-ST, and now he's creeping up on the other AT-STs and killing, blowing them up. Okay, and it's fun, there's some fun moments of Chewie at the controls where the Ewoks are trying to wrest the controls from him, he's like brushing them aside, and it's fine. And then there's another kind of good line, but again, it echoes another film, right? That, you know, Leia's hurt, Han standing in front of her, she pulls out her blaster, right? And she's like, I love you. And he says, I love you. And she says, I know. But hey, we heard this one already, so sorry. Anyway, so they finally, you know, defeat everyone, draw out the remaining troops of the bunker and take them prisoner. So that's pretty much it for the Endor. And they get in there and they throw the charges and they blow the shield. So that's the one part of it, which is the worst. Then there's the space part. The fleet arrives, and there's a cool sequence that, you know, Lando susses out that the generator's still up because he can't get a reading on the field either way. And he's like, why? How are we being jammed if they don't know we're coming? And it's nice. It's a nice moment. And they're still shooting this the way they shot a lot of the first film, right, where you're getting rebels in cockpits, which are real. They're really sitting there. So you get this sense of realism, which I like. But then the wide shots, you're getting just so much activity. There's so many CGI, and maybe it's not CGI. Maybe technically it's not CGI, but I'm going to use the term CGI for the fact that it's not a model. Somehow it exists on screen. Or it's tiny models. I'm not exactly sure. But it all looks very fake. There's so many ships all over the place that you can't get really a sense of the thrust of the battle, right? We get Ackbar's famous line, as a trap! There's no shape to the battles right now at this point. You know, there's some small skirmishes, certain ships get in trouble, other ships rescue them, and you're like, okay, it's a space battle, you know, but I don't feel any real stakes here. It gets a little bit better when the Death Star is operational, because now they're forced to change tactics and draw closer to the Empire's capital ships to sort of protect from that beam. And then it finally, you know, when the shield generator goes down, there's finally the attack on the interior and the death of Admiral Piett. I have sad to say, they blow up the comm tower of the Super Star Destroyer and it impacts in the Death Star and Piett dies. Oh well. But, you know, the interior attack on the Death Star, we've seen it all before, really. And other than Lando, we really don't know anyone else. I think Wedge might be in there. I don't quite remember, but I don't know. It's shot really well. It's amazing, right? It's for 1983, it was probably cutting edge. But even so, there's something very, the emotional heft of the story, really, this is Luke's show. Like, it all rests with Luke. And Han seems kind of wasted in this. And Lando's kind of wasted. Like, they don't have really through lines like they had in the first two movies. They're just kind of around, you know? It's like Morpheus in the third Matrix film. Like, he's just around. And whenever action is centered around these guys, you know, yes, I understand that the rebellion is at stake here, but that's an intellectual thing. You know, I need to see it for real on screen. And somehow, the way they do this battle, I don't. I'm just not, because it's all kind of B characters in the main space battle. There's none of my main heroes. It's just Lando, you know, like, and I think because Lucas spreads things out in three different forks, it detracts from the main, you know. In Star Wars, it was one battle. All your eggs were in that battle. Everyone was in it. Everyone was involved in it. You were focused on it. It made sense. It was intense. You know, here we got the teddy bears attacking the stormtroopers. You know, there's the real emotional core of the films being played out inside the Death Star between Luke and the Emperor. So the space battle, I don't know. It's just, it's ballless in a way. So anyway, so now the other third is the Luke Emperor stuff. And to me, this is the core of Jedi. It's the best part of the movie. It's the best acting, the best scene work, and it's got, you know, the lightsaber duel. So this is really the best part of the movie. And McDermott is just so good. You know, he's so creepy. He's got these great lines. "It is you, my young Jedi, who are mistaken about a great many things." The Emperor knows all about the attack, which is great. And they have this little back and forth, which I like, where Luke says, "Your overconfidence is your weakness." And he says, "Your faith in your friends is yours." Like, he's treating him as an equal in a way because of that exchange, right? So great. But so, you know, he's designed a series of pushes for Luke to turn him to the dark side because he wants to enrage him. The first test is the actual information that your friends on the moon are going to die and the fleet's going to get crushed between the station and the fleet, which has just come out of behind the moon. And Luke passes the first test. You know, the Emperor continues to push him. They stand there. The battle station is actually operational. Now it's starting to pick off the fleet. You know, he's escalating things. And Luke's sort of like, he wants the saber, you know, but he doesn't take the bait. Finally, then, when, you know, the Emperor does push him enough and he is the last straw, and he grabs the saber and Vader intercepts it. And now we're getting, you know, the duel and pretty much the end game. Now, I've gone into this duel in some detail on my previous podcast, but I'll sort of do a little redux version here because I think it's a really, really good duel. There's a nice opening flurry of cuts, very well edited, with medium shots, mixed very nicely with close-ups, right? Then Luke kicks Vader down the steps, and then at that moment he realizes that, you know, he's channeling his hate, turns off his saber. And so Vader has to kind of taunt him, and then comes back after him. They start fighting again, and there are these wonderful quick combinations of, like, 1-2, 1-2. Very nicely done. You know, wide. The camera's back wide enough. They cross sabers and then move up several steps as the sabers are crossed. And we hear the great crackle and hiss of the sabers as they try to overload each other, which is really cool. Then some more back and forth, some more close-ups. Then the music starts to seep in, which is very sinister. You know, sort of the Emperor's theme, I guess. Luke basically bails. He's like, "I'm not going to fight you, Father." And until he's pushed finally to the breaking point, when Vader susses out that, you know, he's thinking about Leia, that it's his sister, and then sort of the last bit of it. So the camera now is on a track, and it's kind of rolling along with them as they fight, but it's all Luke. The music's swelling. It's really good. It's like, you know, because we're kind of like, we're with Luke. We want him to beat Vader down, but we know the more that he is doing this, the more he's playing into the Emperor's hand. So it's a wonderful, there's a wonderful story and pathos to the duel. It's not just sabers hitting each other like the prequels. And Vader is completely overmatched. It's amazing. I love the last part of it when Vader's down and Luke's kind of batting away at his saber. In that moment, I really get a sense that those things are real. You know, a time, finally, there's some viscerality in this film. And then Luke basically changes the angle, hits Vader's saber out of the way, chops his hand off, which is really, really cool. But he doesn't, then the Emperor kind of cackles, he comes forward, but Luke looks at his hand, which is great, which got lopped off by Vader in Empire, and he realizes that, you know, probably remembers back to the cave, throws the saber away, and he realizes that if he kills his dad, he's done, you know, and this is going to be kind of his future, and he bails, you know, and the Emperor breaks out the Force lightning, which is really kind of cool. So it's a great scene. I want to talk a little, before I finish it, the genius of the ending here. Just imagine 99.999% of action movies, sci-fi action movies, you name it, Luke would have killed Vader and killed the Emperor, right? And he would have grabbed the shuttle and walked out our hero. And then showed up later when everyone thought he was dead. He would have been like, "Hey, Luke, you made it. That's right, you know, blah, blah, blah." But the spiritual roots of the trilogy are rooted in this Jedi ethos, right? Which is, you know, you don't surrender to your hate. So what's so brilliant about this? It makes me, it's so bizarre that it's wrapped in basically cotton candy, because the rest of the film, for the most part, is cotton candy, right? He's going to surrender his life rather than become an avenger or an aggressor, okay? But what this does, the sacrifice that he's going to make, he's going to die rather than turn, pulls out what's left of good in Vader. And it also reveals to Vader the Emperor's true nature, because at one point the Emperor is like, kill him and take your place at my side. So Vader's like, shit. You know, the same thing that happens later where the Emperor has Anakin kill Dooku. You know, like, you know, when his old apprentices are kind of used up, he goes on to the new. So this is about to happen here. But the thing here is that it's Vader that kills the Emperor because of Luke's demonstration of sacrifice and nobility. Like, Luke completely embodies, and this is the thing with Luke, right? Because he's not the most powerful Jedi ever. Like, he's not the best swordsman, blah, blah, blah. But what Luke has is this purity of spirit that pulls him through everything. And here, that's the spirit that Vader can't stand by and watch while he allows himself to die. So he kills the Emperor, you know? I don't know if a lot of people remember, but Luke does not kill the Emperor. Vader kills the Emperor. And what I love about this is the notion that evil is defeated by itself because it cannot stand against that kind of spiritual display, which is just beautiful. And I think it's what an incredible ending that, you know, it's Luke's sacrifice that really takes out Vader and the Emperor, because the Emperor's power pretty much does in what's left of Vader. Vader kills the Emperor, you know, and it's just, it's great. It's really great. And then what's even better is afterwards, when the Death Star is coming apart, you know, everything's over for the Empire, and you get this beautiful scene where Luke takes at Vader's request, Luke takes his mask off, and you get this wonderful actor. I don't know his name, but he's really good. And he wants to look on Luke for the last time with his real eyes. And there's a wonderful line, his last lines, where Luke says, I've got to get you off here. I've got to save you. The actor playing Anakin says, you already have, Luke. And he dies. And there's a little bit of a moment. I still get goosebumps when this happens. There's a moment when Luke realizes he's dead. You get a very mournful soundtrack cue, and you're allowed to process the moment for a few minutes. And it's beautiful. It's like Shakespeare, you know? It's really, really beautiful. And soon after, you know, there's also a wonderful somber scene at Vader's pyre. And Luke is burning the body, and there's a wonderful low soundtrack cue, very mournful. And then there's a nice medium shot where you see Luke in full body standing in front of the pyre and looking up at the sky. Really, really wonderful. Like, somehow, miraculously, you know, the end of this movie in those sequences, really, really powerful stuff. And then it's all for nothing, because then it's party with the Ewoks, and there's a goofy moment between Leia and Han where, like, if Luke comes back, I won't stand in the way, so on and so forth, and whatever. Then the three Force ghosts come back to see Luke and you know, kind of tell him they did a great job, which is fine. I didn't mind that at all. And then we are out. Just a brief summary here. Again, it's like Shakespeare wrapped in The Muppet Show to me. It's like the Luke Emperor Vader through line to me is the only thing in this movie that's even remotely interesting. All of the other daring do and action crap and Muppets and Ewoks and all this crap and all the ships and the Death Star 2 and all that, I don't care about any of it. And all of it's weightless to me. Somehow, the story fails to me in that way, because there's nothing really at stake. To say that the Alliance is at stake, you know, it's just different. It's different. It was Han's life at stake, then Luke's life at stake. The stakes were just higher in the first two films. And this, I was there at the end, really, really involved, because my emotions were there. But here, it just, I don't know, it was all so effervescent to me. But the Luke Vader Emperor stuff is wonderful. To me, it heralds what the prequels will be, because Jedi really is kind of a tonal prequel to the prequels, because, you know, he would continue on with his adolescent goofy stuff, you know, wrapped around what are purportedly interesting ideas and powerful ideas. But to me, it all started really with Jedi. And there's also something very flat about it. So much of the dialogue is very flat. The lines, the way they're delivered, the way they're shot. Han is given pretty much nothing to do here. I mean, he really has no part in this movie. Forged dramatic sense to have Han die at the beginning of this film was so smart. It's like I keep saying about The Matrix, that Morpheus should have died at the beginning of the last Matrix movie. It would have ground the film. But obviously, when you're talking about franchise products, you make decisions based on other criteria. If you're just thinking in pure dramatic terms, if you don't have to sell toys, Han's dead. He's dead at the beginning of this film. He sacrifices himself to save the Alliance in some way. Maybe he's the one, instead of this bullshit rescue scene, you know, that he's the one getting the information for the Emperor. Something, you know, where there's stakes and it matters and Han's death should be avenged, whatever. It's all just, you know, Lucas wants everybody to be happy all the time and not in too much danger. So, yeah, so I really do not like Jedi. It's not a film that I revisit often. There are times when I will go back to the final sequence between Vader and Emperor and Luke because I think it's beautiful. But I rarely watch much else. So a little bit of trivia. According to Ian McDiarmid, George originally cast him simply as the physical performance of the Emperor, similar to like what David Prowse is going to be as Darth Vader. He was just going to be kind of the body, and there would have been a voice dubbed later on. So someone, the producer, said if he got his voice close enough to guy named Clive Revell, who did the voice in Empire, maybe Lucas would let him use his on-camera vocals, right? But McDiarmid was like, I can do better. And he came up with his voice. Even Spielberg and Lucas were blown away by it, that like they wound up, that's it. Like they replaced Clive Revell's voice with McDiarmid's in the special edition. So I thought that was kind of interesting. David Prowse only portrayed Darth Vader completely for the first half of the movie. In the second half, the character was played by Bob Anderson, who is a stunt director. During the fight sequence, someone named Sebastian Shaw, who's the actor when the character is unmasked. Admiral Akbar's famous line, "It's a trap," was originally scripted as "It's a trick," but it was negative test screening. So I made it all the way to actual test screening footage, but the did not test well, so they changed it. Originally, the color of Luke's new saber was blue, right? The same one as he had in Empire. However, when a scene of Luke assembling and activating the new saber was cut, Lucas thought the audience might not understand that Luke's Return of the Jedi saber was not the same one he lost on Cloud City. There originally was a scene, and it's in the special edition, not in the special edition, it's in, if you buy like the Blu-ray collection, in some of the extras, they show you the scene where he's in a cave on Tatooine, putting his lightsaber together, and then he ignites it and it's green. They cut that, so Lucas was afraid that they were going to be confused if somehow he got his saber back. So as part of that, it went green. Anyway, that's most of the trivia I have and my take on Return of the Jedi. We're all holding our breaths, you know, waiting for Abrams' The Force Awakens to drop a couple of months from now. My prediction that this movie is going to be fantastic, and I think it's going to harken back to A New Hope in tone and style and how it's shot. I have great hopes for The Force Awakens, and I can't wait to podcast it when it comes out on DVD. That's all I have to say about Jedi. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com or feel free to leave a comment on the website www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is Patreon. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you can search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.